Welcome, everybody, and happy Valentine's. My name is Professor Mick Cox. I'm in the Department of International Relations here at the LSE and director with Arnie Westad of the Cold War Studies Centre. The Cold War Studies Centre, since its foundation a couple of years ago, has promoted two large ideas, or we hope we have. The more obvious of those two ideas is that the Cold War matters, even though it is over. And perhaps the less obvious idea, although equally important, is that its legacy lives on in so many ways. We've explored these legacies through our two big lecture series over the last 2 years. The first one entitled From the Cold War to the War on Terror, and this lecture series, America as Another Country. We continue that exploration this evening with a discussion of one of the most important books written on the Cold War and its legacy by my very good friend, my good colleague, and other director of the Cold War Studies Center, Professor Arnie Westad of the Department of International History here at the LSE. I should immediately say, because we live in the age of Blair, that the book is called Global Cold War, that's not because of Blair, and explores the Third World in the Cold War in brilliant fashion. There's the book, and it's reduced from £25 to £20, and you get a signing outside afterwards. Arnie will open the debate and outline his main arguments for no more than 25 minutes. He will then be followed in the middle there by Professor Richard Immerman of Temple University, who is currently a visitor here in the UK. And Richard, you're more than welcome here at the LSE this evening. Professor Immerman is another of these great Cold War historians, who's gained a high international reputation with studies on the CIA in Central America, Vietnam, and of course his studies on American foreign policy in the 1950s, two enormous books on John Foster Dulles and Dwight D. Eisenhower. Finally, as I say, following up the rear, and hopefully putting us all right, is yet another defining figure who has written on the Cold War, our own Fred Halliday, who has written on too much to talk about here, but he's written on Iran, the Third World, the end of the Cold War, the beginning of the Cold War, the middle of the Cold War, the Middle East, Afghanistan, the Reagan administration, and last but not least, Ireland. I would ask Professor Immerman and Professor Halliday to speak for no more than 10, 15 minutes each. With no further ado, welcome to this lecture and to introduce Professor Westad to begin the discussion on the global Cold War. Arnie, over to you.
Thank you very much, Mick. What we're going to talk about tonight is a book that really started, in a way, about 25 years ago. Usually I do snappy books. I do not do books that last, in terms of the genesis, for more than 25 years, but this one did. It started really when I was working as a relief worker in Mozambique in the late 1970s. And I was constantly surprised at the immense courage and the immense ability that many ordinary Mozambicans showed in the face of war, and in the face of internal disasters. And I was wondering what made this so. What were the links between what happened on the outside, what happened in the Cold War in a global sense, and what happened on the ground, what I could observe in terms of people's behavior within one of the many revolutions that took place in Africa during the 1970s. Now, overall, the Cold War is still generally assumed to have been a contest between two superpowers over military and strategic control, mostly centered on Europe. But the book that we'll be discussing today, on the contrary, claims that the most important aspects of the Cold War were neither military nor strategic, nor Europe-centered, but connected to political and social developments in the Third World. I've argued in this book that while the dual processes of decolonization and Third World radicalization were not in themselves product of the Cold War, they were influenced by it in ways that became critically important and that formed a very large part of the world as we know it today. Some of these influences were coincidental. while others were brought about through direct interventions. But together, these formed a pattern that had disastrous consequences for today's relationship between the pan-European states and other parts of the world. In an historical sense, and especially as seen from the South, the Cold War was, this book argues, a continuation of colonialism by slightly different means. As a process of conflict, it centered on control and domination, primarily in ideological terms. The methods of the superpowers and of the local allies were remarkably similar to those honed during the last phase of European colonialism. Giant social and economic projects bringing promises of modernity to the supporters and death mostly to the opponents or those who just happen to get in the way of progress as conceived by the superpowers and their local collaborators. For the Third World, the continuum of which the Cold War forms a part did not start in 1945. It probably did not even start in 1917 with the Russian Revolution. But in 1878, with the Conference of Berlin that divided Africa between European imperialist powers, or perhaps, as one of my early modern colleagues have indicated, in 1415, when the Portuguese conquered the first African colony. Not even the conflict between the superpowers or its ideological dimension, the emphasis in this book is very much on ideologies, was a new element in this long durée of attempted European domination. The powers that had intervened before had often been in conflict with each other, sometimes as a result of competing ideas. As one of the best analysts that I know of late European colonialism, Joseph Conrad, put it in 1902 in his Heart of Darkness, I think it's probably the most searing critique of colonialism ever published. Conrad says, "The conquest of the earth, which mostly means taking it away from those who have a different complexion or slightly flatter noses than ourselves, is not a pretty thing when you look into it too much. What redeems it is the idea only. An idea at the back of it, not a sentimental pretense, but an idea, and an unselfish belief in the idea, something you can set up and bow down before and offer sacrifice to," Conrad wrote in 1902. The tragedy of Cold War history, both as far as the Third World and the superpowers themselves were concerned, was that two great historical projects that were genuinely anti-colonial in their origins, both on the Soviet and the American side, became part of a much older pattern of domination because of the intensity of their conflict, the stakes they believed were involved, and the almost apocalyptic fear of the consequences if the opponent won. Within this ideological framework, what the book argues is that both Moscow and Washington emphasized modernity as their pattern of rule. In form of what one sociologist, Jim Scott at Yale, has called high modernism, which he defines as linear progress, absolute truths, rational planning of ideal social orders under standardized condition of knowledge and production. And what Jim really means by that is that what both superpowers were after was to streamline the Third World in their images. This is what the Cold War in the South was very much about. The book also argues that this process would have been impossible if it had not been for the willingness of local elites in the Third World, something that Fred has written about earlier on in his work, to cooperate with these grandiose schemes of social betterment through intervention or through social development. Where they ended up, both of them, I argue in the book, was in a war against the peasantry in many of the key countries in the Third World where they intervened. A war that ended up, for many countries, in the tragedy of a permanent or semi-permanent civil war. And these wars that were fought in the Third World during the Cold War were despairingly destructive. Since they were mostly directed against the peasantry, in order to make them stop being peasants, basically, the best way of winning them was through hunger and thirst rather than through battles and bombing. The methods of these wars were to destroy lives rather than to destroy property. In country after country, Kurdistan, Guatemala, Vietnam, Angola, Ethiopia, just to mention a few, peasants were taken off their land, out of their villages, and given the choice between submission and starvation. And even after the battles were declared over, governments continued to wage war on parts of their peasant populations. Much of what the IMF and the World Bank, in the 2020 wisdom of the late 1980s, called often mismanagement or indifference, was in fact warfare, intended to break the will of recalcitrant peasant communities through destroying water resources, destroying irrigation systems, destroying pastures. And the cultural violence was sometimes as bad as the physical violence. Millions were forced to change their religion, their language, their family structure, and even their names to fit in with this image of progress. Already during the late colonial era, the attacks on peasant communities gave rise to new forms of ideological resistance of the kind that may be called identitarianist, affirming other identities outside the immediate discourses of modernity. These were substitutes for enforced identities, programmed behavior, patterns of obedience that were meaningless to most people that we are talking about in this book, and often, and crucially, I think, without noticeable material reward. As the appeals of both socialism and Americanization waned towards the end of the Cold War, ethnicity and religion, exactly those values that Cold War ideologies had attempted to deny, became central to many of the political activists in the Third World. One of those who picked this up very early was the American writer Richard Wright, who was present at the Bandung Conference, when he spoke in the 50s of, and I quote him, a racial consciousness evoked by the attitudes and practices of the West that had slowly blended with defensive religious feeling. Here in Bandung, Wright wrote in the mid-50s, the two had combined into one, a racial and religious system of identification manifesting itself in an emotional nationalism which was now leaping state boundaries and melting and merging one into another. Now, to some of the identitarianist movements that emerged out of the rubble that the Cold War left behind in the Third World, the pan-European West is the enemy, a massive enemy, stretching around the globe in the Northern Hemisphere with colonized outposts in the South, Australia, New Zealand, even the southern cone of Latin America. Because few of these movements have state power, at least yet, and they're generally less powerful than even their local opponents, some use terrorism to state their case, as happened in the United States on the 11th of September, 2001. When they do get to set up states, which some of them are bound to do, I would argue, it is possible that the resentment and anger that empower them will lead to some form of fascism, becoming a new source of violence and instability, both in their regions and elsewhere. Now, this is not a very happy picture coming out of the Cold War, but I believe it's a real one. And terrorism, in this sense, may be the lesser part of the evils that emerge from deprivation and war. Let me turn to the United States and the Soviet Union and their role within the picture that I'm trying to draw up. And clearly, the Cold War era defined their futures, just as they defined the futures of some of the areas they intervened in. What we know, of course, is that the losing state, the Soviet Union, collapsed, ending both Soviet socialism and the Russian Empire. By the mid-1990s, with the non-Russian republics gone, the economy in crisis, the war in Chechnya that Moscow claimed was forced on it by intervening Islamists, but of course local people in Chechnya of Muslim origin would say is an anti-colonial struggle. With this all happening, the global role of a superpower seemed like a strange dream, I think, in the 1990s or even today to most Russians. In the naive cynicism that many of them chose to put on in wake of the fall, trying to negate their own past and show themselves as citizens of the world, meaning the capitalist world, there were also solid portions of racism. Some claimed that the Soviet Union had been taken advantage of by Third World regimes and movements who, aided by corrupt officials, had helped themselves to the wealth created by the common Russian. I remember very well that after the Nobel ceremonies in Oslo in December 1993, when the clerk of Mandela got the Peace Prize, a commentator in Izvestia, this is just 2 years after the collapse of the Soviet Union, wrote, and I quote him, "One could understand if the Nobel Peace Prize had been awarded to the clerk 3 years ago. What he single-handedly changed the course of the ship of state away from apartheid. But what had Nelson Mandela to do with it? It was the clerk who released him from prison and provided the opportunity to legalize the ANC." This is the official mouthpiece of what had been the Soviet Communist Party just 2 years after the collapse of the Soviet state. Whatever Russians believed they saw out of the ruins of the Soviet Union, the direct economic costs of foreign intervention were not the main causes of the Soviet collapse. During its last 10 years in power, the CPSU, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, spent less than 2.5% of total state expenditures on military and civilian assistance to the Third World. Although relatively more, I believe, than any other country at the time, one should remember that those figures include most of the costs of the war in Afghanistan, which by itself took up roughly half of the total. So in real economic terms, the Soviet Union could almost certainly have continued its foreign interventions, even though a period of stagnation and decline would have followed. The problem, as I argue in the book, and I won't go into detail on that here, is that the combination of the cost of interventions and the very high level of overall military expenditure was what got the Soviet Union into trouble vis-a-vis its other superpower competitor. Now, while one superpower collapsed, the other one went on to become the hyperpower of our time, as the French would have it, rather correctly, I think. As is becoming clear from the new Cold War history, it is unlikely that historians of the future will date the emergence of the United States as a hyperpower to the beginning of the 1990s. Indeed, it's likely that many will see America as entering this phase at the beginning rather than the end of the 20th century. And from this it follows that the Cold War never saw two equal superpowers. One was distinctly more super than the other, even though its power was never limitless. America just had more of everything during the Cold War. Power, growth, ideas, and yes, modernity. And the expansion of all of these aspects of the United States is one important part of the history of the Cold War, domestically and internationally, as the Cold War Center notes in its lecture series this year. Which gives me the opportunity to say a good word for Karl Marx for once. He was certainly right in foreseeing the United States becoming the main revolutionary power of the 20th century when he wrote in the 1850s and 60s. A power that would sweep long-established economic, political, and cultural patterns before it on its way to global supremacy. It transformed trade and financial markets, creating a new form of world economy. It defeated its enemies, Germany, Japan, eventually the Soviet Union, while setting the terms for the democratic revolutions that reshaped their politics and their societies. It inspired fundamental changes inside and among its European allies, helping to do away with privileges, do away with social obedience, create more open societies, create a process of transnational integration, aiming at creating a European Union. It created also, I think, a new form of audiovisual culture and patterns of consumption stimulated by it. And it created a third world by repeated interventions, by its need for raw materials, almost boundless, and first and foremost, by its vision of development. Surveying these massive processes of change, some historians have tended to confuse power with morality. Seeing the United States as generally a force for good in the world, they have concluded that an inherent morality is both the cause and the principle for America's international role. I think that such a nearsighted conclusion can only be explained in ideological terms. The identification with the vision of the future that Washington represents is so strong that the moral qualities of that vision outshine all its other aspects. In a manner strikingly similar, I would argue, to that of its communist opponents, the aim therefore outweighs the character of its actions. Such an approach, of course, is not only intellectually faulty, as many writers have shown, but also, as the Soviet case proves, it is dangerous in the extreme in the longer run for the state itself. That the United States, for a variety of reasons, is an immensely attractive society. I've spent a lot of time myself in the United States and come to appreciate it. Does not excuse the violence with which the United States has attempted to influence the world, especially in the third world regions that we are dealing with today. Seen from a third world perspective, the results of America's interventions are indeed truly dismal. Instead of being a force for good, which they were no doubt intended to be, and this comes out very clearly, I hope, in the book, these incursions have devastated many societies and left them more vulnerable to further disasters of their own making. So far, the combination of stable growth and stable democracies that Washington has ostensibly sought may be visible only in two half states. You may guess which those two are: South Korea and Taiwan. But it's absent in around 30 other countries in which the United States had intervened directly or indirectly since 1945. Meanwhile, the human tragedies for friend and for foe that this scorecard reflects are enormous. Moreover, for many countries, these are ongoing tragedies. They are still with us today, after the Cold War ended, with enough landmines and other weapons in place to destroy lives well into a generation yet unborn. In the 1990s, as I've argued elsewhere, very few people here, or indeed in the United States itself, cared much about this scorecard. In a period of increasing wealth, including increasing personal wealth, for most of us. But in the new century and the decade we already know, some of these difficulties really came home to roost. I like the quote in an interview I did with the CIA's Afghan specialist, Milton Bearden, where I asked him, you know, what did you think about the long-term future of these parts of Afghanistan that you intervened in during the 1980s? And Milton responded, and this is his language, not mine, did we really give a shit about the long-term future of Nangarhar? Maybe not. And as it turned out, guess what? We didn't. Unquote. The Clinton administration put the tough questions, such as the debt crisis, increasing world poverty, security time bombs in Korea and Palestine, aside for others to deal with. With matters taking the natural course towards improvement in the third world, it was believed, places such as Nangarhar, which was, as some of you will know, Fred certainly will know, one of the birthplaces of the Taliban, could afford to wait. They even faded from the view of the US intelligence community during the 1990s. As one CIA officer put it to me in the summer of 2001, quote, operations that include diarrhea as a way of life simply don't happen, unquote. In spite of the temporary reliance on natural forces in the 1990s, the new and rampant interventionism that we have seen after the Islamist attacks on America in September 2001 is not an aberration, in my view. It's a continuation, in a slightly more extreme form, of US policy during the Cold War. The main difference is, of course, that now there is no other global power to keep US intentions in check, such as the Soviet Union did, at least in a few cases. But the ideology of interventionism is, in my view, very much the same, with the same overall aims. Only by changing markets and changing minds on a global scale can the United States really be secure. And this new offensive, undertaken to be sure in the face of massive provocation, as 9/11 certainly was, aims big. And its slogan is more strongly put forward than ever before. I like a quote from the State Department's erstwhile official spokesman, Richard Boucher, when he gave a Thanksgiving address in London the year before the invasion of Iraq. And Richard said, quote, I declare myself an unabashedly simplistic American. I believe in freedom as a right, a responsibility, a destiny, a force that cannot be vanquished. And in my line of work, meaning the State Department, it is more than a fate. Freedom is a foreign policy. The United States will defend freedom relentlessly. To me, that is what it's all about, plain and simple. The United States stands for freedom, defends freedom, advances freedom and enlarges the community of freedom because we think it is the right thing to do. Now, the American-led invasion and occupation of Iraq that we have discussed much during this lecture series offers, in my view, a prime example of how freedom and security has been and remains today the driving forces of US foreign policy. As often happens when the most powerful country goes to war, the security aspects are diminished when the intervention gets underway and the opposing state folds. In the Iraq case, of course, the reduction of the security scare turned somewhat to farce when there were no huge arsenals of weapons of mass destruction to be found. What remains then, in this situation, meaning Iraq and others, is the ideological quest for freedom as defined by the United States. We heard about this in the lecture last week. Threatening, in the case of the Middle East at present, to turn Iraq into a nightmare of unending conflict in the same way as happened so often to countries during the Cold War itself. I was asked that as I was making this book, when I gave a lecture at Yale, can there be an end to American interventionism? I see it, in terms of how I defined it in this book, as unlikely, but certainly not impossible. The book shows that the United States has been an interventionist power for most of its existence, and its emergence as the global hyperpower has made this more or less into a permanent state of affairs. But there is also another America, as we know, symbolized by the resistance to the war in Vietnam, the protests against the intervention in Central America, and the opposition to the invasion and occupation of Iraq. This anti-interventionist fringe, my study shows, is strongest when it can demonstrate how wars abroad defeat improvements at home. In ideological terms, the only way of breaking the bond between what Thomas Jefferson described as interventionist tastes and democratic theory is probably, as it should be in all democratic states, through appeals to what serves the country best. It's a debate that, in my view, the United States needs now, because as global resistance to US interventionism increases, its democratic practices will come under increasing pressure at home. Without a genuine reorientation of its foreign policy, American democracy may end up suffering the same fate as Soviet socialism. At the end of the Cold War, I'll conclude in a moment, Mick, when he gives me that eye, I know I come to the end of the lecture. At the end of the Cold War, about 1 out of 4 of the world's inhabitants lived in areas with improving standards of living. Today, the lucky few, if the IMF's own figures are to be believed, number less than 1 out of 6. And the difference between the numbers is increasing rapidly. In the long run, it will be impossible for a dwindling privileged minority to impose its economic, political, and military fiat worldwide. Unless there is reversal of these processes of impoverishment that are described in the book, the impoverished majority necessarily will begin to turn the tables on the United States and on the rest of the pan-European world through intervening in its affairs in the same way as it has over centuries intervened in theirs. In this context, I have argued, and this is probably the one sentence in this book that I've got the most flak for, that those crimes that were committed against the people in the Twin Towers of New York City on September 11th was no bigger or smaller than those committed against the peoples of Luanda and Kabul during the Cold War. In light of the history of the recent past, which the Cold War really is, the greatest shock of September 11, 2001 was certainly where it happened, not the murderous act itself. In my view, much of the future, or common future, North and South, therefore depends on how we revise our actions in order to reduce the potential for violent conflict overall. If there is one big lesson of the Cold War, as I see it, it is that unilateral military intervention does not work to anyone's advantage. While open borders, cultural interaction, fair economic exchange, in the end, benefits all. This is, as I've argued before in this room, not a pacifist argument. I believe firmly in the right to self-defense when attacked. But it is an argument that recognizes, as indeed this book does, that in a world that is becoming increasingly diverse ideologically, just as communications are beginning to tie us much more closely together, the only way of working against increased conflict, violent conflict, is by stimulating interaction between societies and countries while recognizing that diversity and, when needed, acting multilaterally to forestall disastrous events. The Cold War remains a dire example of what the world looks like when the opposite happens and regimes of global intervention takes hold. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Arnie. And now over to Richard Imam. Richard, over to you. What's your update? Yeah.
Let me begin by thanking Professor Westad and Professor Cox for inviting me to contribute to this discussion on Arnie's new book, The Global Cold War. I would be delighted to contribute to the discussion of any book dealing with the Cold War, even if it is on Valentine's Day. It's a terrific topic. But in this case...
Depressing topic.
Right, it is. Now, in this case, I really get to offer some comments on what is truly a wonderful book. Characteristic of so much of Arnie's previous scholarship, the Global Cold War is characterized by just remarkably impressive research. It is multi-archival, it is multilingual. And quite literally, there is no one who has exploited materials that have become available over the last decade and a half to the extent that Arnie has. And unlike others, whose names we mentioned, who I won't mention except their middle name is Lewis, he uses the original documents as opposed to relying on the Cold War International History Project for translations and other things like that. This is truly international history at its best. Further, the scope of his coverage is just breathtaking. I am unaware of a single book study of the United States and the Third World, or the Soviet Union and the Third World, that examines policies so broadly and comprehensively and with such insight and sophistication toward Africa, toward the Middle East, toward Central Asia, toward Central America and the Caribbean, and more, as does the Global Cold War. And yet in this book, he examines policy of both the United States and the Soviet Union towards all these areas with equal depth and sophistication. And of course, as he mentioned in his comments, his stress is on both the policies themselves and the consequences of those policies, and on both the exogenous and indigenous factors, forces that influence both those policies and their consequences. For this reason alone, it really is a tour de force. I would present it as a model to my students, but I fear that they would be so intimidated that they would never write again, because no one really other than Arnie could have produced this book, given his abilities, not to mention 25 years is a long time and 10 years supposed to come along somewhere during this way.
Better than 6 months.
Right. I also congratulate Arnie on appreciating the continuities as well as the discontinuities between the Cold War era and previous eras, particularly of European expansion, imperialism, and conquest. I hope we can discuss this more during the question and answer, because it does anticipate a a point of debate that will rage, it really hasn't even begun yet, which is whether 50, 100 years from now, there will be a Center for Cold War Studies, that scholars will be treating the Cold War as a distinct entity, an organizing principle of our studies, or that it'll be merged in a larger era and a larger period. I have a colleague who's absolutely convinced that people like myself have about a year and a half more to go before we'll be overcome. I'm not convinced of that, but I do see where the argument can, how the argument can be made. And finally, I'd like to congratulate Arnie for really restoring the Third World, to use that term, to its rightful place in Cold War history. Somewhere around the mid-1980s, near the end of the 1980s, as the Cold War was really winding down, there developed a very strong thesis, argument, particularly among political scientists, those who were quote-unquote realists, that the Third World didn't matter. It didn't matter at all. The argument was that all that mattered were countries that basically conformed to the traditional calculus of power, how much, what their military capabilities were, their resources, or whatever, and the Third World didn't do that. In fact, interestingly enough, reflecting this perspective, on the back cover, there is a blurb from Bob Jervis, who is as good as they come in terms of political scientists. I think his work is absolutely fantastic. And yet, in this, he describes the Third World generally as, and I'll quote, of little intrinsic value. That is the perspective of the political scientist. And I think, in many ways, in this very welcome intervention, Arnie all but turns this perspective on its head. And you know, I hope will point future scholarship, including of political scientists, in a different direction. Well, having made clear, I think, that I like the book a lot.
We were waiting for the bus.
I'm consequently going to offer some very brief comments that are not really criticisms, but rather in the hope of raising some other questions, some challenges that can serve as a foundation for our discussion subsequently, and perhaps can add some additional texture to the overall argument. To begin with, I want to sort of raise a question about the periodization that Arnie sets up in the book. He writes at the beginning, and see, I did get a chance to read the book carefully, which he didn't have in his comments, and I'll quote, that the superpower conflict in the Third World was at its peak, and when the developments in the Third World have the most significance for the wider conduct of the Cold War during the 1970s and 1980s. He says that's where he focuses the book. Actually, I'm not quite sure that that is really where he focuses the book. And in fact, he's quick to add that the earlier period, the 40s, but particularly the 50s and the 60s, were, of course, significant, but only by the 1970s did the conditions in the Third World and the capabilities of both superpowers reached the stage that made events in Africa, Asia, and Latin America central to international affairs. Well, I'm always sort of troubled or get a little nervous in these sort of broad generalizations, but in this sense, I'm worried if it doesn't sort of provide almost a misleading context to understand what comes subsequently. To begin with, it's sort of dangerously close to the type of Atlanticist perspective that actually Arnie has spent a career undermining. But more than that, I think there's robust evidence in the archives, particularly in US archives, that at least after the success of integrating NATO, particularly the Federal Republic of Germany, into NATO in the mid-1950s, U.S. policymakers, especially, came increasingly to perceive that the Soviet Union had basically given up on Europe, Berlin crises notwithstanding what would come afterward. at least given up their ambitions in Europe and turned their attention toward the Third World. And in fundamental respects, Arne's own book seems to suggest that. He quotes John Foster Dulles entertaining the possibility of a reverse Bandung in 1955, because, as Dulles acknowledged, the scene of the battle between the free world and the communist world seems to be shifting. And I think that what I'm suggesting is that by the middle of the 1950s, before the Cuban Missile Crisis, there was a growing perception that the Third World is where it was happening. That was going to be the battleground. And of course, then you get the responses over the Suez Crisis in 56, the Algerian Revolution, et cetera, what was going on. Arne argues or concedes that the Soviets did rediscover the Third World in the 1950s, suggests that this is really the product of the death of Stalin, the emergence of Khrushchev, and the accelerated pace of decolonization. I don't in any way question that, but I do think that one has to sort of juxtapose what's going on in the Third World in activity with this general sense that the battleground was no longer in Europe, and I think that was suggested, that was sort of in a way borne out by what happened at the end of the Cold War. I'm not, I'm raising this not really to say, well, he's wrong, but again for us to try to examine what historians do, which is the influence of change over time, and try to trace that change and the variables or the catalyst for that change in as systematic a fashion as we can. The other major issue that I want to raise, and this is really the bottom line, and it concerns highlighting the role of ideology in both the United States and the Soviet Union as sort of the motive that in the one hand, that both drove and sustained the succession of interventions throughout the Third World. His argument that really what happened to the Third World was in fact a battle for hearts and minds, as much as it was a geostrategic or over political economy or whatever. And in fact, what is interesting is that the titles of his first two chapters, I think, set this up very well. On the one hand, you have America's Empire of Liberty, and it's versus the Soviet Union's Empire of Justice, both claiming that theirs was the true path toward modernization, formula for modernization, whatever modernization really is. Now, unlike many historians from the United States who study U.S. foreign relations, I tend to agree that ideology is important. But I do that sort of almost on faith, sort of instinctually. Like many of these historians, I have found it very, very difficult to locate evidence that suggests or that supports the judgment that ideology is important. Indeed, in a whole bunch of my studies, including the one of John Foster Dulles, who's about as ideological as they come, at least according to the stereotype, I began with the premise that, of course, ideology mattered. And I found all these expressions of ideology, but almost always they were for public consumption. They were in the public arena. They were books that he wrote. They were speeches that he gave. They were television interviews in which he struggled to actually even pronounce the word communist. Behind closed doors, though, when the decisions were made, the discussions almost exclusively hinged on security, almost always security. So you had ideology up here, and then you had security down there. And connecting those dots is extremely difficult. It's like those who try to develop operational codes, and they often have to rely on the public. Comment. Well, to some extent, I think the same held true as you go through the narrative in Arne's book. I kept having to remind myself specifically, particularly in the United States, that this was about ideology as opposed to something else. there was a much more precise correlation between ideology and behavior when it came to the Soviet Union. And particularly his incredibly masterful treatment of the Soviet decisions first to intervene in Afghanistan and then ultimately to withdraw from Afghanistan a decade later. But even with the Soviet Union connecting dots, let's say in Angola or Ethiopia, was a little more difficult. My question is, I guess, whether ideology is a constant, whether there are degrees of ideology, and whether it affected both states the same. And this also relates to the question of what is an ideology? How does one define it, the composition? Here I mentioned Artie uses this term, empire of liberty, to deal with the United States. It's a great term. It's taken from Thomas Jefferson. We all know that. Everybody uses Thomas Jefferson. Innocent enough. Well, not quite. It's more complicated. Arnie chose the phrase empire of liberty, which comes from a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote in 1780. In 1809, he writes another letter, this one to James Madison, in which he uses the term empire for liberty. One is or, one is for. Now you're going to say, God, there's that academic doing all this semantic stuff. In fact, I think that this wasn't by accident that he changed his term. That for is a much more dynamic term, suggesting sort of a more aggressive, more expansionist policy. I think it captures in many ways the ideological roots that really he's writing about through the Cold War. All I'm saying is that this is really complicated. It's complicated by sort of a book Walter Mead wrote not too long ago, sort of Special Providence, in which he divides American ideologues into four categories. They're the Hamiltonians, they're the Jeffersonians, they're Wilsonians, they're the Jacksonians. It's actually silly to do that. I mean, it's very hard to fit people into these boxes. But I think that the problem represents something larger, that ideology is sort of arranged hierarchically. I like to use the term belief systems, that people believe different things and in different orders, what is more important and what is not. Everyone believes in freedom, but the question is sort of where it ranks. Let me just conclude then by just a note about the final point, which of course everyone wants to talk to about, which has to do with Iraq. And the argument that he said at the end, that what happens is that security is replaced by freedom. And this is the driving impulse. And it just, I would suggest that it was exactly the opposite. That it is security that continues to reign supreme, and that most recently, and maybe we'll get a discussion of this, that the current Bush administration has turned John Quincy Adams on his head, in that the famous quote about America does not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. I think, in fact, America does go abroad in search of monsters to destroy, because all of those monsters, they believe, are thinking of destroying the United States. So once you destroy one, you then move on the other, and you're right. Who matters, you know, what you leave in its wake? Thank you.
And finally, Fred Halley. Fred.
Thanks very much. Well, it's a great pleasure to be speaking here this evening, discussing this fantastic book. I wish I'd written even a part of it myself. And I also noticed, very interestingly, an undercurrent of the LSE's influence in this. In the chapter on Ethiopia, you make great use of the PhD thesis by Andagachu Tirone, which he did here with James Mayle, very brilliant critique of the Ethiopian Revolution. I notice one or two other LSE people pop up now and then, particularly on the vexed question of the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen. But in your discussion of the role of ideas, I was struck by something, that there are two dominant ideas in the Cold War, indeed in the 20th century, which inspired both the great powers, the major protagonists you discuss, and also third world peoples. One was the American vision associated with Walt Rostow, Stages of Economic Growth, famously subtitled A Non-Communist Manifesto. And the other was, broadly speaking, the economic theory of imperialism, which was filtered through Leninism, through Maoism, through dependency theory, and which lives on today in much of the rhetoric of the Islamists. And both these ideas originated in LSE. Rostow did his PhD thesis here in the Economic History Department on British industrial development in the 19th century. And I heard him speak at this very podium about 20 years ago, very interestingly, about how it was that study of Britain in the 19th century and the lessons he drew from it which led him to write Stages of Economic Growth and inspire the Non-Communist Manifesto. And of course, the economic theory of imperialism did not begin with Lenin. It began with John Hobson, who was a temporary lecturer in the school. We refused him tenure. And yet his idea probably did more to influence and legitimate the 20th century radical movements than any other single idea. It's also a subtext which I'd recommend to the Cold War Studies Center to write a study of the LSE in the Cold War. Because we had many interesting incidents here. I remember one contrast in the early 80s. An American professor came to see me, East Coast guy in a bow tie, you know, fit and all that. And he said, Halliday, got two questions for you. How much do they pay you? And can you choose your own graduate students or the dummies in administration do it for you? Well, I said there were no dummies in administration, but I didn't quite tell him how little they paid me. But anyway, those were his questions. We got on fine. Then a Soviet guy came. He was unwell. He had lived through the siege of Leningrad. He spoke six languages. He quoted Pushkin and Boris Godunov and all these things at me on every occasion. And he said, "Dear Professor Halliday, for you I have two questions. First of all, are the books on your shelves yours, or did they come with the job? And secondly, how many days a week do you have to come into the office?" And I think these were differences of culture. I think the British would take one of each, but I leave it to you to decide which of the two they take. We also had, it's no secret, the odd spy. Miss Valerie Plame of now Libbygate fame was a student in our department. I was indeed a supervisor, and a very intelligent and experienced person she was at that time. I remember writing in my reference that she came to the school with considerable diplomatic experience, which was perfectly true. We also had visitors from other intelligence agencies. I remember lunching occasionally, as many of us did, with journalists from the Soviet bloc who were more than that. I remember one character who turned out later to be a KGB colonel saying to me, "But you're a British professor," he said. "What are you doing dealing with these dangerous, opasni elementi, these dangerous elements, nienadojdi, unreliable people from the third world?" And when I said, "Who do you mean?" He said, "Look, my friend, there are three kinds of dangerous people in the world. Number one, Bulgarians. Number two, Cubans, and number three, Palestinians." He said, "You're a British professor." He said, "Even your watch and your briefcase are shabby. What's wrong with you? You should..." And he warned me of this. And I remember later in Moscow, as Arnie did visiting the institutes in the 80s, being very struck by something he talks of here. But again, I would wind the clock a bit further back. The disillusion in the Soviet Union with the Third World, well, as he rightly says, and I would emphasize it very much, really the biggest disillusion of all with China, and the very interesting discussion in his book of the marginalization within the whole Soviet decision-making and foreign analysis sector of the experts on China for many years, because it was simply too sensitive a subject. But if the Americans had a Vietnam syndrome as a result of the departure from Saigon in 75, the Russians had an Egyptian syndrome. The expulsion, they invested a lot in Egypt as a non-capitalist road country. They armed the Egyptians. Although it was not announced by them or by the Israelis at the time, they fought the Israelis on the canal in the war of attrition of the late 60s. Indeed, the Russians took part in 18 undeclared wars in the Third World, we now know as combat pilots and other things, including, of course, Korea and Angola and Yemen. The loss of faith in the Arab world really set in from the late 60s, of course, especially after the 67 war, with a broader loss of faith in Arab socialism. But I also remember they, having great disdain for the Palestinians, and remember one senior Soviet official saying to me, Arafat kakieta. Arafat is a flirt, he's a coquette. He comes to us and then he runs off with the Saudis and the Americans, and we can't trust him. So that disillusion was there for a long time. Now, there are many things in Arne's book which I would very much agree with, and just following a previous speaker, mention them quickly. I would argue very strongly against the history. I got my PhD in the International History Department, but my supervisor never read a line I wrote, I have to say, except to give me one very good piece of advice. He said, don't call it the foreign relations of the People's Democratic Republic of Yemen, call it some aspects of the foreign relations, which was actually saved me many years of my life, so I'm very grateful for that. Against the continuous historians, I would stress discontinuity. I'm with Hobsbawm on this one. The period 1914 to 1991 was the prolonged European Civil War, with the three chapters of the First World War and its consequences, the Second World War and the Cold War. And although there were imperial elements, although there were colonial elements, and although some of the issues of the Cold War live on today, not least bin Laden, who was set up in business by Reagan and the Saudis and the Pakistanis, I think the Cold War was a distinct chapter, the third chapter of that European and then global civil war, and should be treated as a distinct issue. And therefore, I think in the issues, interests of trade unionism and employment, that Cox and Westad should be employed for many years, and their successors and PhDs for many years to come. However, I take very much the argument that Europe had settled by the early 60s. Alan Lynch, who is probably one of the political scientists that were mentioned, has written several books saying the Cold War was over by the early 60s. But in the Third World, it most certainly was not, and I would argue it was not over in Europe. First of all, there was the minor but very dramatic events of the Portuguese Revolution, a fine example of how the Third World affected a metropolitan country. But more importantly, I would argue that in the end, side by side with, not necessarily more important than, side by side with the wars of the Third World, the rivalry of the two social and economic systems in Europe was the decisive battleground of the Cold War. And in the end, the Soviet Union did not collapse through Managua, Luanda, Maputo, Aden, Addis Ababa, Asmara, Hanoi, Kabul, Ulaanbaatar, and so forth. It collapsed through Berlin, Prague, Warsaw, Sofia, and so forth. In other words, it was the superiority of the very boring but successful European Union, democratic and prosperous. Remember what the East Germans said on that night, wir wollen Kiwis und Nektarinen, we want kiwis and nectarines, and other things too, of course. Backed up, of course, by an element of military force, which in the end undermined communism. So Europe quietly remained a central front, despite the fact that only in Greece in the 40s and only in Portugal in the 70s was there a serious Cold War. Secondly, he reminds us of the cost. 20 to 25 million people died in the Cold War, in the terrible wars that he mentions, which we should never forget about. Undoubtedly, the most sinister person I ever saw speak in my life at Chatham House was Jonas Savimbi, a person who with a terrible and murderous record. Arne dedicates his book to two people, one of whom I knew very well as well, Ruth First, who were murdered in the Cold War. And in fact, I have an amateur project on unsolved murders of the Cold War, and every week I come up with new instances of this, starting, of course, with Kennedy himself. He also discusses the multidimensional nature of the Cold War. The Cold War was, in part, an imperial conflict for zones of influence and allies. It also involved the nuclear arms race, which I'll come back to, which was a distinctive issue from previous imperial wars and colonial rivalries because of the dangers involved. Remember the Tom Lehrer song of the early 60s, we're all going to fry, and many of us believe that. It was also a war, a conflict about ideology, about how to organize the world, two different social systems, capitalism or socialism. And it was a war against colonial and foreign rule in the Third World. It had all those dimensions. It had other dimensions. It had the gender dimension. The gender history of the Cold War, feminist history of the Cold War, is a very interesting history to write in the way in which gender stereotypes and gender policies were used by both sides, and the way in which the gender issue came to the fore in both East and West in the 1960s. Perhaps the most dramatic gender issue moment of all, which was really a debate of two forms of stereotype, was the famous kitchen confrontation with Nixon and Khrushchev in the American domestic exhibition in Moscow. Khrushchev went into the kitchen and picked up, I think, some way of boiling an egg, which was more easy to do than normal. I can't remember what it was. Anyway, I said, what on earth is this? And Nixon said, well, this enables women to cook more easily. And Khrushchev said, our women don't need these ludicrous devices. And so you had a kind of American modernist sexism and Khrushchev's peasant sexism colliding in this ludicrous discussion about how to boil an egg. But in that, there was much about the Cold War. But I would also strongly agree with him about the importance of belief. The belief in Moscow, belief in the U.S., part of which, of course, was nationalism. We know, and Arnie's points about the collapse of internationalism revealed a very strong Russian nationalism, something I certainly encountered when I started going to the Soviet Union in the early 80s. And the United States was no laggard, and is no laggard in this regard. But belief also in the Third World. These people who fought and died, the Mozambicans who Arnie mentioned, and the Yemenis and the Ethiopians and the Afghans and the Cubans and the Grenadians and others who I saw at first sight, they believed in fighting imperialism. They believed in sacrifice. They believed in creating a different world, just as those who fought against them for the West or for Catholicism or for their rights to retain the land and property they had also believed in it. And the worst disservice we can do to the Cold War is to forget the passions and the aspirations and the utopias which drove people on both sides. In the famous phrase of the historian E.P. Thompson, we must rescue the past from the condescension of the present. And the condescension towards people in the Cold War, I think, is very pervasive indeed. In the spirit, not of criticism, but of setting ourselves intellectual questions we will never resolve, but we should ask, let me, however, make a few other points. First of all, I think we have to look very carefully about this question of Europe versus the Third World and try and write a history of the Cold War and of the collapse of the Soviet Union, which brings both accurately into the picture. I don't think we've got there yet by a long chalk. But if I look back on the mistakes I made in the Cold War, and it's a good list of them, in 1989 I published a book called Cold War, Third World, in which I argued that with the détente in Europe, the balance of the conflict had shifted to the Third World, and of course, Soviets were on the run in Afghanistan, but the South Africans were on the run in Namibia and Angola and much else besides, and argued that the Third World had become the center. Well, I proved to be quite wrong, because as I said, it was in Berlin, it was in Prague, it was in Warsaw, that the tide really turned. And those regimes did not immediately fall. Indeed, several of them, Cuba, not to mention China and Vietnam, are still very much there. Secondly, I think we have to pose the question, and here I would have a different emphasis to Arnie's on the overall story, on how far was it the intervention of the Americans and the Russians, or the aspiration of people to follow their models, that determined the course of events in the Third World, and how far was it indigenous social and political movements, how far was it the political sociology of revolt and counter-revolution in the Third World? And I would argue that the internal roots of revolution in China, in Vietnam, in Ethiopia, in Yemen, in Cuba, and so forth, and also the places where it was suppressed, as in Chile and Bolivia and Southern Africa for a long time, should be given a much more central role, but they will not come out in the archives of the hegemonic powers. This is, I say so, the risk of relying on the documents from Moscow and Washington is that the indigenous long-term and immediate social causes are obscured, and I think they should be brought much more back into the picture. Then there is the very important question of nuclear weapons. Part of the Cold War was nuclear weapons and the fear of nuclear weapons. And the question posed, how do we write a history of the arms race and of technological development and of proliferation and all these other things that isn't purely technical? In other words, how do we write the economics, the politics, the ideology, and how far did political factors affect the arms race, not just technical ones? The most obvious case of all is the Cuban Missile Crisis, a politically incorrect term, because as the Cubans say, they had no missiles. None of the missiles were Cuban. It was the Crisis de Octubre, the October Crisis of 1962, When the United States faced down the Soviets and forced them to withdraw their INFs from Cuba, but why did the Russians station the missiles in Cuba in the first place? Well, part of the reason was certainly an arms race reason. It was to counter the American INFs, the Thors and the Jupiters in Germany and in Turkey. As Khrushchev said, we will put a hedgehog in Uncle Sam's pants. But it was also to protect the Cuban Revolution from another invasion, which is why the Cubans wanted it. In other words, the politics of revolution and counter-revolution played a central part in this deployment, as indeed they played in its solution, because although the United States never gave a guarantee not to invade Cuba again, in fact that is what occurred, and the Cuban Revolution is still there today, degenerate and very much reduced as it is. If we look at the negotiations that Arne discusses on Afghanistan in the 80s, Gorbachev was very clear in talking to Chernaev and others that he had to pull out of Afghanistan in order to get a favorable deal on INFs in Europe. And the Americans, for their part, were holding up negotiations with the INF because of the Cuban advances in southern Africa. If we fast forward to today, why is there such a fuss about the Iranian nuclear program? There is an intrinsic nuclear proliferation issue there, but clearly the fact that Iran has missiles stationed, non-nuclear missiles stationed in Lebanon with Hezbollah, that it has now got the upper hand in Iraq, that basically the Americans are on the run in the Middle East, and they know it, and how, and they've just been in Washington recently, is an added factor for pressure on Iran. So we have to write a political and social history of the nuclear weapons, and also not reduce it, as many of the critics did, to the sort of inexorable Weberian workings of modernity and exterminism and bureaucracy and all the rest of it, as people like C. Wright Mills and E.P. Thompson tended to do. Finally, I think that we have to take this very interesting book by Arne and ask, how does it challenge our disciplines? How does it challenge international relations, and how does it challenge international history? Well, I've said that in the case of international history, I think we have to remain on guard against the hegemony of imperial archives. And this is a long-standing problem. It isn't made easier by the fact that the counter-archives may not be there, but I would argue in the end that it was the indigenous working out of social forces, revolutionary and counter-revolutionary in the Third World, aided, abetted, seeking to win the support of the great powers, rather than the intervention themselves which determined that outcome. But if international history has to ask questions, so does international relations. We teach our students that there was something called the Westphalian system, which for hundreds of years respected sovereignty and the separation of states and societies. And our friends who write on globalization say we're now moving into a post-Westphalian world. But if you read Arne's book, there was no Westphalian system. There was no respect for sovereignty anywhere in the Third World. It's not just a myth. It's actually bad conscience to claim that the Westphalian system ever existed in the Cold War or indeed in the colonial period. And it's a terrible story of manipulation, intervention, and as he said, the terrible war on the peasantry, which cost the lives of 20 to 25 million people. Brings me to the final point, which again is something that I got singularly wrong, and it's this. In my own irritation with my IR colleagues who said, don't worry, guys, it's all continuing as before, the end of the Cold War doesn't affect international relations at all, the eternal verities apply, be they the Marxist verities of capitalism or the realist verities of, what are the realist verities, make that sort of balance of power or something, that sort of thing.
That'll do.
Sort of stuff we teach, anyway.
Yeah, that's good.
And the sort of pull up the blankets, there's really nothing to worry about, it's business as usual. I argued very strongly that the end of the Cold War marked a major rupture in world history and that important theoretical lessons and consequences followed from it. All very fine and dandy. But what I didn't see, and I would say this very strongly, was the degree to which, and here Arne is absolutely right, is the continuities, the unsolved business of Islamist armed groups who show up in Manhattan and in various odd ways around Madrid, London, and elsewhere, and I suspect will continue to do so in a sporadic way for many years. The unsolved business of uncontrolled nuclear warheads, fissile materials, waste all over the former Soviet world. The unsolved business of inflamed inter-ethnic conflicts. The unsolved business of money laundering, corruption, and new rentier states like Russia, Russian Federation, which are degenerating and proceeding even as we speak. But beneath that is something else, and here I come back to the point about ideology. Yes, the Russians and the Americans believed in a vision of an alternative world, but they were also profoundly arrogant. They retained European colonial attitudes, even though they were not the major obvious colonial powers themselves, towards non-European peoples. And those attitudes we see today. Where do we see it? We see it in Abu Ghraib. We see it in the video of the British troops beating people up in Basra. It's the deep continuity, and here I think the continuist historians are onto something, between the colonialist past, the Cold War, and the post-Cold War world, the absolute contempt for people who are not from your own country and not of your own color, and how deep that is, as it comes out in debates on immigration, on European expansion, on Turkish entry, and in the horrendous pictures and videos we see. And the only explanation I have for the conduct of the British and American armies in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and even more so in the cover-up by senior officials, by ministers of defense, by governments, is the unresolved, unacknowledged continuity of brutal colonialist arrogance of the kind that Joseph Conrad wrote about and Roger Casement also wrote about, may I say, 100 years ago. So, yes, the Cold War was a distinct period, something dramatic did change in 1991, but I must say I've had to revise my thoughts about how great a rupture it was, and indeed I would also qualify my judgment about the discontinuity between the Cold War and the colonial period, given what we see in front of us in Iraq today. Thank you.
Okay, everybody.
We have about 20 minutes thereabouts for questions, answers, short interventions, unlike the superpowers in the third world. So can we start the ball rolling this evening? Do we have a question to go? Is Emerson? He's down here. Please, sir. Could you take the microphone over to General Nett? If you just throw your hand up and I'll try and spot you. Please, yeah.
Just a very general comment. I mean, could it have been any different? Because in a way you seem to argue almost from a kind of a broader philosophy of history perspective that you had all these kind of modernization dynamics. And in a way, could it have been possible to intervene or to have all these transformations without this much violence, this much degree of violence? Thanks.
Just a quick comment on that. Well, what I say in the book is that really, because of the emphasis that I put on ideas and how people envisage the world, you know, they see the world before they intervene in it, as it were, or before they draw up an alternative world and an option that they want to fight for. Unless that view changes, no, there are not very many options. It's not, as one of the reviewers of the book said, I mean, this is certainly not the Greek tragedy. I mean, it's not given in advance. There are alternative visions that come up. But within that core understanding of the roles in the world that the American elites and the Soviet elites had during the Cold War, much of what they did made perfect and logical sense. I mean, just like Fred underlined. Now, I happen to think that in most cases, when we analyze foreign policies, that does hold true. But that's not the same thing as saying that there is no alternative, there is no option, only that the people who are in charge at that particular moment are not capable of thinking otherwise.
Richard, do you want to have a...
Well, I mean, part of it has to do with sort of the level of analysis. In other words, whether we're talking about a broad international state system going back to Westphalia or the domestic or ideological underpinnings of a state and society or the individual who in fact, are focusing on. I think, you know, my own view is that people do make choices. So in all cases, someone does make a choice to behave in this manner or the other manner. and as a consequence, it is not inevitable. I think to some extent that's what distinguishes history from other disciplines, in that in many ways it is a humanity, and it does come down to different individuals making different choices at any time. Although, as Arnie says, I absolutely agree, they're clearly driven by their own sort of worldviews, ideological mindsets, whatever you want to call it. But when ultimately a decision is made at a certain time.
Fred, did you want to come in on that at all?
Okay, there's a gentleman over here and a gentleman here. Yeah, please. Thank you.
And one can see a great deal to be gloomy about, but I just wonder if we are overlooking that there are some perhaps rays of sunlight here.
Can
I
mean, speak up, please. Yeah.
Yes. What one outcome of the Cold War is that the capitalist system has become the dominant system. And this does seem to be a far more efficient system, like it or not, but in which underdeveloped countries can actually get into some sort of liftoff. There's a number of examples, and there's countries that one can see developing, that this whole idea of a world with a very small and a fixed number of wealthy countries that are becoming steadily more beleaguered but by vast numbers of poorer people may not necessarily be the outcome, that you may see countries like India and China actually developing and this model changing over the next few decades. And I just wondered if we can't gather some sort of optimism from the fact that, like it or hate it, the capitalist system does seem to be a better vehicle for the world to develop.
Okay, let's take capitalism is better. And gentleman here, yeah, and then take some, yeah, please, brief.
I got the impression, please correct me if I am wrong, that your thesis is that the objective of the American interventions during the Cold War was to establish democracy. And then you express surprise that out of a half a dozen interventions, the only countries which have managed to establish democracy was South Korea and Taiwan. Well, this cannot really be as simple as that. Surely, I mean, they were American interventions, probably indirect, in countries like Chile and Indonesia, which does not fit this pattern. And another theory would be, of course, that the objective was not the establishment of democracy, and the fact that Taiwan and Korea managed to become democracies is just because of the geography and the ideological historical orientation of these two countries. I mean, obviously Taiwan and South Korea, of course, were inherently anti-communist, if you like. So how would you face up to this kind of interpretation?
Okay. Fred, do you want to begin? Do you want to have a go?
I'm reminded of the saying of an American, very charming American Stalinist friend of mine.
What?
He said, the great problem of the 20th century, he said, capitalism got lots of chances, socialism only got one. Well, cynical remark. The preconditions for the development of democracy lie, as you say, within countries. And the United States' record during the Cold War was not a very opposite one as far as the promotion of democracy is concerned, nor is it going to be in the Middle East as a whole. But linking this to the earlier question, I think that the jury is very much out as to whether capitalism will in fact be able to lift up other countries in a Rostovian or Keynesian way. I don't exclude it, and I think Marx himself was also undecided about this, given the number of things he said in his work about the potential for the development of capitalism. But the problem is that the original Marxian, or even rolling forward 100 years, Keynesian perspective has been made much more complicated by the new obstacles that we have, of which demographic explosion is one, the environment is a second, and now the rise of extremely ferocious ethnic and irrational religious forces. So I veer towards pessimism, but if I had to put my money on anyone in the world today, I'd put it on Amartya Sen and say, you know, where Amartya Sen goes, I will follow. and let's try and do our best. The sort of Pied Pipers of the far left, or what I call the bunkerists, have nothing to offer, aesthetically pleasing as they may be in some of their pirouettes. When I read my former colleagues in New Left Review saluting the struggle of the people of Iraq against the U.S. and its U.N. accomplices, in other words, celebrating the slaughter of Sergio de Mello and his U.N. colleagues in 2003, I'm sorry, this marks a point of division. And therefore, let us try and make the world a better place if we can.
Richard, did you want to come in on any point there?
Well, just, you know, very briefly, what I was trying to say at the beginning, I think the United States interventions were motivated in the main much more by security, their definition of security, than democracy, although democracy was important. The problem is that establishing democracy is very difficult and very costly, and it was not anything that the United States was particularly interested in paying that price.
Just a very quick comment on the democracy issue, just to make sure that the argument I'm putting forward is not misunderstood. What I'm talking about is the interest and indeed the willingness of the United States to spend an enormous amount of money and effort in order to promote a ideal of liberty and freedom, which is profoundly American, and therefore does not fit the kinds of societies that we're dealing with in these cases. I would even argue, as I indeed do in the book, that in the cases of South Korea and Taiwan, and here I would very much go along with what Fred had to say earlier on, most of the developments that leads towards some form of democracy, much larger public participation in policy making that you find in most other countries in the region, come from within. So I see this, yes, as an American crusade in terms of understanding what the aims are in the longer run, but these aims are connected to what America's mission is seen as being, not to what is actually happening on the ground in the countries where they're intervening.
Yeah, I've got a question at the front here and then a question up there, please. Yeah.
Maybe just a chance nice to follow on to those comments there, but I'd like you to, Professor Wested and others, to develop some of your, or talk more about your thoughts on this relationship between the rhetoric of liberty or democracy promotion and the goal maybe of national security, and whether these are mutually exclusive or how one affects the other, particularly the role of any external actor with this intervention, although they're focusing on national security, how democracy promotion or these ideas, greater ideas of liberty, can be promoted.
Okay, and there's one there, please. Yeah.
Yes, thanks. I had two questions. Well, that was my first one. And my second question is, what or do you talk about, you know, in your book about learning from failure, the notion of learning from these interventions? I would be interested to hear.
Okay, Ali, do you want to start on this?
Yeah, because this was an important issue that was raised during the comments as well. A vision of liberty, a certain view of liberty, or the role of security overall as main motivations behind interventions. Now, the way I see it, and what ideology does explain, is how people think, how they see the world. What makes them do things that they otherwise would not have done? That's the reason why I emphasize it to the extent that I do in the book. As an historian, it helps me explain matters. Why things that otherwise would have been incomprehensible, or at least very difficult to explain, make sense within a view of the world that is not our own and that we may not even be very sympathetic to. Now, security matters. None of the countries that I'm dealing with in this book would disregard security, or if they do so, they only do it at their peril, as they very soon find out. The concept of security is premeditated by the way they see the world. Who is a security threat is defined by how you understand the world to work. Iraq was a definite security threat to the United States, maybe not in the way the president presented it, but in terms of the American ambitions overall within the Middle East. There are hundreds of these kinds of examples with regard to the Cold War, going back to the very early days, where you can see security as certainly being there, but security as defined by someone. So when you hear about a country being said to be of great strategic importance, then you should stop up and think, strategic importance to whom? Who created the map that made Korea or Malaysia, or even in the strangest twist, Ethiopia, to be of key concern to global politics? I mean, this comes from somewhere. And I think this is the link that I've been trying to establish in this book between thinking about security and thinking about our own place in the world, from the one who wants to express a view on security or a view on strategy.
Fred, do you want to come in on that?
No, often said in the Cold War, you know, the more remote someone was from anywhere, the more people said it's strategically placed.
Yeah.
Some island in the middle of the Pacific, or some remote Kordofan, or Hadramut, or, I don't know, I mean, you know, places that we met, even Grenada, I remember, was strategically placed. I don't know what.
The plant lies buried in the sands of the Ogaden,
But it is striking. We've spent this hour and a half, and Arnie's written this book, and I would have done the same, discussing the Cold War and the relative balance of indigenous and external forces. And we don't mention one thing, which throughout most of the Cold War was regarded as absolutely central to explaining, which was economic interests. Oil, warm water ports, raw materials. I mean, we all got in a lather. I didn't actually get in a lather about this, but I wrote the odd thing, trying to get the ladder off, as it were, about how the Soviet policy of the Third World was driven by the desire for oil in the 70s, or warm water ports, or access to not quite grenade and nutmeg, but you know, or Cuba and something or other. All the Americans were in Vietnam because of the rubber plantations. And that was how much of the thing was perceived, both polemically, but also in the academic literature. And yet, are we saying it's totally irrelevant? Are we saying that all the theories of imperialism or of Soviet exploitation of the Third World or Eastern Europe or of Afghanistan was anything to do with the gas and so forth? I think the answer is probably yes. I mean, I think Arnie's probably got it right. But it is amazing. Somebody came back from a discussion 20 or 40 years ago. I'm just thinking recently the death of, at 92, of the great American writer Harry Magdoff, I mean, who wrote a lot about this question. Now we just don't discuss it. Of course, may I say there are other important questions discussed in the school where economics never figures. Nationalism, may I say, they never seem to link the two, whereas I thought they had got something to do with this plunder and robbery and territory. But anyway, that's an obscene and sectarian thought to tell you about.
Yes.
But the main point is that as you say, security is mediated through ideology, and here the arms race comes back in. But I want to come back to this point, the link in the perception of Soviet and American leaders between nuclear deployments and technology on the one hand and third world security and security on the other. In Moscow in 1981, the head of the Oriental Institute took me out to lunch, and he said, and I think he believed it, if we had not gone into Afghanistan, there would have been cruise and Pershing missiles on the Afghan-Soviet frontier within a year. And I heard Eugene Rostow, Walt's brother, who was long-term security advisor, speaking at Chatham House in 1980, and basically laying out the program of the Reagan election campaign and saying, we've got to build up our strategic forces because the Sandinistas are within 48 hours driving of Galveston, Texas. And the point he was making was there was a kind of tariff for a very visceral connection between these apparently separate domains, which exactly bears out what Arnie said, which I thought was absolutely brilliant, about security being conceived in these terms. And that's part of the unfinished business of the Cold War. Just one other thing on does the Third World matter? I think Kennan, who I once, by the way, next Wednesday is the 60th anniversary of the sending of the Long Telegram. So 5:30 in the afternoon, I once asked him this question, which is really in some ways the start of the ideological Cold War. But it's also, he didn't think the Third World mattered that much, and particularly was against the war in Vietnam. But the extreme argument was made by a very eccentric right-wing writer called George Gilder, who said, actually, Third World revolutions are good for America, he said, because all the bright guys leave and come to America, and all the dummies stay behind, he said, in that way. So he was almost saying, let's have more Third World revolutions. But it was a way of making this point that they didn't alter the overall balance of things, which you mentioned Jervis said in a more polite way. I have want to offer one controversial thesis. I think the Cold War was good for America, because while there was the McCarthyite period, which persecuted some hundreds of people, the civil rights movement of the early 60s was a product of the Cold War. Was it called to account America? It's hypocrisy. It was opposing the Cuban Revolution. It was proposing the Alliance of Progress. It was promoting ideas around the world. They could not go on denying the vote to millions of blacks. And combined with social struggles in America, and a very powerful struggle it was, millions of people got the vote. So actually, far from thinking that it strengthened the national security state and the authoritarian nature of America, in that period at least, I know Americans don't like me making this argument, I'm going to make it, Cold War was good for America in that respect.
Right, I'm going to take a couple more who've had their hands up. There's a gentleman at the back with the microphone, and there's a lady here, and then I'm afraid we'll just have to take those two and allow people to sum up.
I was just wondering that it's very easy to forget that that the Cold War was actually a lot messier business than we remember, and then when it comes to America's role, it's very unclear, because certainly in the State Department at the end of the Second War, one of their war aims certainly was the end of British colonialism. And then if you look at their role within Suez, how Britain rejects Nasser, and then Nasser courts Egypt, just in the same way that we talk about push and pull in migration, we'll be talking about push and pull of regional conflicts in the Cold War. And the only other little point I make is that it seems to me also that the whole nature of international development and economic development is a direct product of the Cold War as well.
Hi, I wanted to ask if you could talk a little bit about the Sino-Soviet split and how this was played out within this wider context of superpower interventions.
I'll give you 10 seconds each on that small issue. And gentlemen, back finally.
Yeah, just to add, in terms of the concept of international development, the book mentions the concept of Cold War, Third World intervention. Does the author believe that the interventions were basically Eurocentric, based on the idea of capitalism versus socialism, and that the Third World, as was mentioned earlier, as a concept, was a loser socially and economically?
Okay, thank you very much. I think that's plenty to go on with. Richard, would you like to make any summary points? Then I'll move to Fred and then Arnie to sum up.
In terms of these questions?
Or in general, you can now say what you always wanted to say in public.
I just wanted to make one little formula that goes back to some of the overarching questions, and I certainly don't want to talk about the Sino-Soviet split with Arnie sitting next to me. But in terms of this, I guess my premise would be, again, in terms of the United States, that the United States only feels secure and therefore believes that it can retain its ideals and institutions in a global environment in which others basically accept those values and accept those ideals. And in that sense, that Arnie is absolutely right in terms of the role of ideology. Having said, consequently, in many ways, it did intervene in the world, and this goes back before the Cold War, in order to establish that environment. The problem is that since the United States ideology is based on the concept of American exceptionalism, there is no possibility that anyone other than America can accept its ideals and values. Consequently, at the end, the United States can only live in a world that is safe if the whole world is made up of Americans. And since that's not going to be the case, you have the problem that exists during the Cold War and exists today. So that's where I see the relationship.
We'll think about that one, Richard. Fred, any final general comments?
Yeah, on the Sino-Soviet dispute, I have a particular interest in debates on internationalism. It's very striking that throughout the history of the socialist movement, from the 1800s onwards, the question of internationalism, meaning how do you coordinate a common line, but also how far do you go in supporting other struggles, has been a kind of lightning rod for every single major split of the socialist movement. Marx and the anarchists, Lenin and the social democrats in 1914, Stalin and Trotsky, and then the Sino-Soviet dispute revolved around this question. And clearly material interests were involved, the most obvious material interest being, would the Russians give the Chinese nuclear technology, and Khrushchev going back on earlier understandings, the question of the Chinese economic path rather than the Soviet one. And in retrospect, of course, the Chinese, far from being in the long run, reckless and destroying everything, as Khrushchev thought, actually preserve their agriculture, which is now booming, whereas Russian agriculture isn't. But it did also involve, again, ideas about how far to push revolutionary struggle in the context of nuclear weapons. Remember, Mao said it didn't matter if his city got blown up, it was just a small country. However, I have to say, my brother and Yong Chang, when they were doing their Life of Mao, found the man who wrote the Chinese texts in the Sino-Soviet dispute, and he said they're all hot air. I didn't believe a word of it. So whether that's in fact true or not is an interesting comment of where the Sino-Soviet dispute actually got to.
Lots of things I'd like to comment on here, and we simply won't have the time for it, so I'll have to apologize to many of you whose questions I'd like to touch on, but won't have the time to do that now. It happens particularly midweek that you'll find me over at the George the Fourth pub, so if any of you would like to continue some of these discussions, that's a good place to start looking.
At least I won't have to buy the drinks anymore, I mean, that's for sure.
You're going to discuss the Sino-Soviet dispute and the George Fourth. This is fantastic.
Well, exactly. I mean, talk about long durée. I mean, there are some
issues.
I've tried to put together three sort of broad questions that I'd like to address very, very briefly. One, going back to what Richard was saying in his comment about the earlier period being of significance, 1940s, 1950s, 1960s. I would certainly agree with that. I have no problem with that whatsoever. What I argue in the book is slightly different from the way it came out in the discussion. What I argue is that it's in the 1970s and 1980s that what is happening from below, which is hugely important to me, I mean, what's happening within the countries that I look at, merge with what is happening from the outside. And that's why the 1970s and 1980s are so immensely destructive in terms of the Cold War in the Third World, and the reason why they get, at least in an imaginary sense, this enormous importance seen from Washington and Moscow. So it's the merging of those two that, to me, are important with the 1970s and 1980s. They do not come from there. They do not originate there. And what goes on earlier on is definitely
the Korean War.
The
Korean War was exactly that.
Yes, I mean, yes. There are, and you could go even further back than 1945, as I indeed do in the book, in talking about the early part of the 20th century, and to the irritation of some people, even much further on. I think the earliest date in the book is the one I cited with 1415, but there might indeed be other 18th century dates that would involve the Cold War, to the irritation of some historians who do not like to think in that particular direction. Anyway, so that's on that one. Second question, linking what one of the important points Fred made with the question about learning lessons from interventions, the Egyptian syndrome that Fred mentioned, looking for repeats. Now again, I think Fred got this right. I mean, what they were looking for were the lessons that they thought they could draw from earlier experiences, particularly those that had gone badly wrong. And it's very clear that when it comes to Afghanistan, for instance, the Soviets are thinking very, very much about what happened in the early 1970s in Egypt. One of the intelligence chiefs that I interviewed, Shevardnadze, was saying that our biggest fear was that Amin, the Afghan president, would do a Sadat on us. So, I mean, but this is a form of mechanical learning. It is the kind of learning that really goes back to the world, again, the way you want to see it. In terms of actually learning from history, I mean, with a capital L and a capital H, I see very little of that going on during the Cold War. And that's actually one of the things that set the whole period apart, at least for me, believing, as I do, that it's not impossible to learn from history. On the issue of the centrality of Europe, let that be the last one I comment on. I fully agree with what Fred said and what others have been repeating, that in terms of the outcome of the Cold War, what happened within Europe was the dominant aspect. But there are two ways in which that need to be looked at from the outside or from the south, as it were. Much of the changes that took place in the 1980s happened both in the Third World and in Eastern Europe. Indeed, some of the challenge to the centralist, statist projects did not just happen within range of countries going from the Baltic states and onto Albania, it also happened in the Third World roughly at the same time. And this is one of the things that we are not really able to explain yet. It has very much to do with ideology. It has to do with how people see the world. And suddenly, lo and behold, they started seeing the world differently from what they had before, including people who themselves had been active participants in the left-wing revolutionary projects of the 1970s and even the early 1980s. And then secondly, with regard to legitimacy. Part of the problem that the Soviet Union got when it got into the 1980s, and very much because of Afghanistan, as Fred alluded to, was a legitimacy problem. I mean, the Soviet Union was left as the last major European power fighting what many people in the Third World would see as being a form of colonial war. Now, if you bring that back in terms of undermining legitimacy both at home and within Eastern Europe, I think it had a tremendous effect. I remember myself being in Poland in the early 1980s, right before the introduction of martial law, and with the Poles realizing very acutely that what was happening in Afghanistan also had a direct impact on what would happen in their own country. So there are links here that are hugely important to explore, and we are just getting started on that now.
Thanks very much, Arnie. Before I came to the LSE a few years ago, I was always told there were two things about the LSE I needed to remember. The first was the dastardly role played by the LSE in bringing down the British Empire, and by every single taxi driver in London, that it was, of course, 1968 and those bloody communists who brought the country to its feet. I've learned here tonight something else, that the LSE clearly played a central role in the Cold War as well. So the LSE's role in history is continuing to be told here this evening. Could I briefly announce our next meeting here at the Cold War Studies Centre? It's on the United States and the global environment, but I thought that sounded boring. So I've actually called it the United States' global polluter. But I have given it a question mark. And that will be on the 1st of March with Crispin Tickell and Robin Eckersley. Could I also secondly remind you that Arnie will be doing a book signing outside, although not for free. Nothing is for free, as we were told by one of the gentlemen in the audience. Capitalism is a good system. Well, it certainly is, so get your book for £20. And finally, I'd like to thank our two distinguished discussants this evening for their wonderful contributions, but especially once again to thank Arnie for his great talk this evening and for a great book. Arnie Westad, you've done well.
Great.